Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today we're introducing a new program serving New Haven that's been a long time coming. We're going to speak with a representative from Continuum of Care about the recently launched Compass initiative that's training and equipping teams of social workers and peer support specialists to respond to crisis intervention and mental health emergencies. Then we're going to pick up where we left off a couple of weeks ago, drilling into the latest Valley Community Foundation's Community Index, bringing in the CEO of Team Incorporated to discuss challenges involving early childhood care and housing in the Lower Naugatuck Valley. And we're going to close replaying a recent chat with Aware Recovery Care to remind you about their unique, successful in-home recovery program, along with the critical roles played by loved ones as part of the recovery team and not just the ones shouldering the entire challenge. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. NAMI Fairfield is presenting a program entitled Tips from the Trenches, Navigating a Mental Health Event. It's happening on December 7th at 7 p.m. in the First Congregational Church's Wakeman Hall on Beach Road. A State Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services Mobile Crisis Team member is going to be the guest for this in-person presentation on how to cope with a mental health event. There will also be time set aside for questions if you'd like. More information on this and other programs and NAMI resources, visit the NAMI chapter website. It's namifairfield.org. So folks may have heard over the past year or so, definitely over the past few months, whether you're here in Connecticut or listening to this as a podcast or a webcast somewhere else, that a new movement is afoot, and that is to provide the optimal response to crisis intervention and mental health emergencies in our towns and cities. So this is happening right now in New Haven, thanks to a program called COMPASS, which stands for Compassionate Allies Serving Our Streets. And essentially, what it will do is provide a supplemental team responding along with police and or EMS or other law enforcement in situations where there are crisis intervention or mental health crises happening. And we're pleased to be talking with John Labinick, who is with Continuum of Care, the administrators of this service and a partner in developing it in New Haven. He's VP of Acute and Forensic Services at Continuum of Care. So, John, this is such an exciting development. I mean, you know, 30 years on this program, and I can't tell you how many times I would have somebody representing law enforcement expressing such extreme frustration in situations where frontline responding police officers didn't really have the training or the tools to be able to produce a best outcome in a lot of situations. We obviously have heard ad nauseum the number of folks in our who are incarcerated who actually have mental health issues and probably shouldn't be in a corrections situation. And we have heard the hopes of these kind of programs developing. So kudos to you and your team that it's here. I understand this has come together as a result of a really important group of collaborators. So let's start with that.
Yes. Sure. And I got to say, you know, my 20 years working in the field and working crisis services, I share that same excitement. I've been invigorated with the work that we're doing. Sure. And being able to be out there as well and training staff and just doing a program like this is important, and it's been very exciting.
If I had a dollar for every individual at a mental health agency or a public organization who said, this person never should have gone into the judicial system, or this person, you know, their last resort was to face law enforcement intervention when that was probably the last thing they needed. So this is fantastic. Yeah. So who's working on this with you?
Well, we have, you know, I just got to say kudos to the city of New Haven for doing this, because they put a lot of time, thought, and effort into this. And they've also worked with the Consultation Center over at Yale, who's our administrators, in implementing this and collecting the data. This project started several years ago with looking at, first, really focusing on the community. And service providers, and getting feedback from everyone that about the crisis response system, and they came up with this project based on that that feedback, and they did some extensive data research with the 911 calls, and here we are today. It's been great.
So has this been replicated off of another initiative that already has proven positive results somewhere else? Or is it a hybrid of another system that then brought some unique components to it that are more New Haven centric or, you know, kind of Yale system centric?
Well, I think this is a unique project in terms of how we got here, the work that was put into how we got here. And we also have a really, really amazing community advisory board, you know, based on citizens from New Haven, people with lived experience. And our team is unique in the fact that we are civilian-led. So there are other programs that are doing similar things. But I think where we come in and doing something unique and unique for New Haven is that we've only been operating for a month, and we're doing secondary responses, and there's a big research component to this. But the goal is to eventually find those primary calls that we can be dispatched to. And we're also doing outreach, which I think makes us unique as well.
So there, and this, the success of this program is in no small part going to be, you know, sort of elevated by the training and the embracing of it by everybody from frontline emergency telecommunicators to fire and EMS responders and, of course, law enforcement, right?
Correct. And, you know, the we've gotten just such a great welcoming invite, and the collaboration and support from the first responders and the police department has been remarkable.
Well, when you've been using a hammer for, 50 years and somebody hands you a nail gun, it's a pretty magical moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the awesome thing about this program is your Compass teams are actually peer recovery specialists. So when these individuals go out, they are potentially able to kind of hold the head of the individual in their hands and look them in the eye and say, you know, this, you are me 3 years ago or 5 years ago, right?
Yeah, that is the beauty of peer work and having that lived experience. I often say that lived experience is something you can't teach. So they bring such a value to the team. So we go out in pairs, a social worker and a peer with lived experience. And that combination has just been really remarkable because our approaches are different and it works.
Talk about the training. This is so intriguing to me. How the individuals who themselves may have been the subject of a crisis intervention call at some point in the not too distant past are trained to be part of the Compass team that's going out and already making a difference here in Greater New Haven.
Yeah, that's a great question. And we're fortunate, our agency is fortunate enough to have a pretty robust peer program where we do apprenticeships, we have an employment opportunities, and we We employ peers in all of our service programs. We have like 56 different sites across Connecticut. So having that robust peer program, we've already had some of the basic training of mental health, trauma-informed care, de-escalation, learning about boundaries, learning about working in the system when you were once part of a system. I would say we're good in that department. We've come a long way in that department. We have some really wonderful trained RSSs. The outreach component in responding to these 911 calls, I don't know if there's a good training out there for it, but what we did was we went out with the police. We did ride-alongs, and we met with the police, and we got the direct training from them. So that was great. That was awesome. And I think it's the outreach component. We've done some training on outreach and engagement, which is out there. And I think the foundation, though, of that trauma-informed care, the de-escalation, motivational interviewing, those types of foundation trainings we've already have established within our agency.
So what are the nuts and bolts of the program as it stands today, as we're talking about it here in early December? Is it, daytime, nighttime, around the clock? How is that all working?
Yep. So right now we are operating from 10 to 6. We've been operating for just about a month now. We've had 63. We've responded to 63 911 calls. A third of them have been the self-initiated outreach. And the program operates out of our crisis residential program, which is just a perfect fit because we've been doing crisis work in New Haven for over 30 years. So it was just a good match for us, and it was a complement to our services now to have this team. And what's happening is between the hours of 10 and 6, we're currently going out as a secondary response, and that's for the purpose of really, training, seeing what's out there, seeing how we're going to be useful, and gathering the research and the data that we need. So after that initial phase, we're looking to go to two teams so that we would be in operation from 8 a.m. to midnight. And then that will go on for a little while. We'll continue to collect data and research, and then we'll reconvene and see what we are going to do with the third team, whether it'll be during the overnight hours or do we need to double up on teams as these calls increase and the need for our services increase.
So for skeptics out there, whether they're in Greater New Haven or somewhere else where a similar program like this might be eventually inspired, who are saying, why do we really need this? It comes down to, what goes into or comes out of their pocket in terms of tax dollars and how those tax dollars are spent. Because, the eventuality, I guess, is you guys want to provide a measure of response so that police and or fire and potentially even ambulance service that may end up due to the individual's economic situation may revert to the taxpayer for the bill. So there are a lot of kind of collateral cost drivers and points where the Compass program could actually be an exceptionally economic advantage.
Well, we're going to be doing 30-day follow-ups with folks that we've engaged with. We've done a lot of engagement with even families that have really struggled to navigate the system for their adult child, when it comes to mental health services or addiction. We've done death notifications as, social workers, just being able to provide some resources to folks and kind of knowing how to operate in during that grieving process for people. So that I think the research is going to speak for itself, and I am like so confident in that just based on the work that we're doing now. And the officers and paramedics and fire have told us themselves that they are often feeling so helpless having to leave a situation and not be able to help. And I could give you an example of that. We had a domestic call, and it ended up being a family situation where, there was some abuse going on, and we were able to which took us, you know, probably about 3 hours, but we were able to get this individual into the right setting, you know, a safe, supportive place. Whereas just because of the way that things unfolded, the police wouldn't have had time to do that.
Nor
is it really something they, you know what I mean, in terms of navigating that system and finding the resources. And then an eviction process we had gotten called to, and we were able to take over the scene and really help the person that was being evicted come out safely and provide resources, you know, to get them into a safe place and work on additional housing resources. So it's really a matter of letting the police do their job and allowing the citizens of New Haven and the people of New Haven and the ones that are struggling a resource to navigate our sometimes pretty complex system.
And that's the beauty of the involvement of continuum of care. You have your own back. Bone of referrals and agencies and contacts where a police officer on the front line can't be expected to pick up the phone and dial one number and get right to the right person at the key agency that that individual needs in that moment or may need in a week or a month. You have that number. And and you can make that happen. That's fantastic. And if I'm reading the data right, eventually, once this program is at full capacity and running on its full schedule, you may be intervening on upwards of 10,000 plus calls a year just in New Haven.
Yeah. There's a lot of need. There's a lot of need out there. And being able to offer, you know, the support and help people during emergencies and a crisis like that is, you know, the folks that we've integrated with and been involved with have been nothing but appreciative. We've been following cases, making sure things don't fall through the cracks, because that's what often happens. You know, the system is just so complex and navigating it is difficult for anyone. So being able to help in that fashion has proven to be really successful.
Oh, great. We appreciate your time this morning, kind of orienting myself and our listeners to this new program. Hopefully, there are some individuals out there who work in other communities who see a benefit to something like this where they live, and may be calling on you to borrow the template. That would be my wish. John Libinick is a Continuum of Care Vice President of Acute and Forensic Services, talking about the recent launch of their Compass Teams, Compassionate Allies Serving Our Streets, interveners who will work first in concert with and perhaps independently in the near future to respond to crisis intervention and mental health emergencies, and hopefully serve as a model for other communities here in Connecticut. John, really appreciate the information today. Well, folks who may have been listening to our award-winning For the People a couple of weeks ago heard us sort of in impromptu fashion discover and kick off what we are planning as a series centered around the Valley Community Foundation and the release of its latest index of issues that are impacting the quality of life, health, economy, and other issues in the Lower Naugatuck Valley region. And so we are now entering into what essentially is the second segment of that. And we've got the right person to talk about a couple of things that are really impacting health, economy, and the quality of life in the Lower Naugatuck Valley. We're going to talk about early childhood development and housing today with David Morgan. He's president and CEO of Team Incorporated. They're a national leader in not-for-profit management and program performance in the field of human services, early childhood, family support, and community engagement. They're an organization I've been familiar with 3+ decades, working both as a journalist in the Valley and as a broadcaster here at Connoisseur Media. So it's great to have Team back on the program, David, I must say, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk. We're going to sort of strategize straddled the midpoint break, hitting on two of these critically important issues that are obviously affecting folks across the state and nation. But in terms of the community index for the Lower Naugatuck Valley, as we heard and you mentioned before we went on the air, you've got 40% of the population you serve who are sort of living in this Alice category, this income constrained but employed group of people. And as you also mentioned, and we really need to reiterate, the cost of early childhood care I hate to put the word mainstream child, but a child who may not require additional supports is essentially the equivalent of a year's worth of mortgage payments. And then you add other health factors, developmental factors, educational support factors. And we're talking a huge chunk of change that so many people can't begin to afford.
That is a lot, and you're absolutely right, John. And I appreciate you having me on. And Connoisseur Media is so good to the team and to many of us in the Valley. And I want to amplify that Alice piece you said, because that really looks at the true costs of a household survival budget. To your point, what are the actual costs that are facing our Valley households towards the basic necessities of life, from housing to childcare, food on the table, transportation, healthcare, medicine, et cetera. And we really need to look at that 40%, as you said, because these federal poverty levels and these low-income self-sufficiency numbers, they're so outdated and they don't truly reflect what is bearing down on our residents. 4 out of 10 are struggling to meet the basic needs for themselves and their loved ones based on real costs. And as you said so well, housing and childcare are major headliners bearing down on people's budgets.
So in a perfect world, if an individual was able to earn enough to be able to afford average to optimal early childhood care, what's the price tag? Not to get down to dollars and cents, but can you give us some idea of the price tag on that?
Sure. Great question. So the average, on a weekly basis, the average weekly cost right here in the Valley, and it's very similar across the state of Connecticut, is approximately $300 per week for a young child, infant toddler. So that's infant birth to age 3 for a child care program. $300 a week for a preschool age child, that's before they go into kindergarten, from ages 3 to 5. On average, it's about $240 per week. And if you were to compare that to the average, the median household income, when you look, imagine if a household with a preschooler, you know, a 3 or 4 year old and a newborn or an infant, they would be asked to be paying almost $28,000 per year just to access childcare.
So
which is 35% of the Valley's median household income, 35% of their income.
Because there's no economy of scale here. It's the cost multiplier is in gross numbers per child, give or take.
That's correct. And there's just no public investment in childcare. So it falls on the backs of families to pay these, like you said, these payments that rival a mortgage payment. And frankly, it falls on the backs of the workforce who are not paid adequately to the parity of the K-12 system. You know, the K-12 system has a public investment. There is not one in birth age 5. So it falls on the backs of childcare workers and on the families. And we should all be very concerned, because there's two critical pieces here. We knew this before the pandemic, and it was further amplified during the pandemic. Without reliable childcare, 1 in 3 workers throughout the state of Connecticut, right here in the Valley, are parents. They have dependents. Childcare works so parents can work. We saw that with COVID-19 recovery. A lot of our large corporations and businesses, big name businesses, saying we have a 5-year expansion plan, and we would hear the headlines, my workers are back, except for the ones who are desperately trying to find childcare. And then other large corporations and businesses, small and medium, saying we have expansion plans, but there's not adequate access to childcare. So it's a very vulnerable system that lacks the investment. And so the bottom line is, child care is a critical element to the economic vitality of any community, any neighborhood throughout the state of Connecticut, and certainly for a household and working people's gainful employment. And then the second piece is just the art and science and the education of what we know about early childhood development, the neurological and physiological development of the human being. What we know from birth to age, from prenatal to age three, there is more rapid physiological, neurological development going on during that time period compared to the remainder of the entire human experience. And then by age five, the human brain has developed at 90% of its capacity. And from, you know, I know we'll talk about education down the road from K to 12, but you look at a 2-year-old's vocabulary size who has access to quality child care. The Harvard Center for the Developing Child has done this research. Their vocabulary size at 24 months, 2 years old, is 442 words. A child in low-income, disadvantaged conditions, unable to access a quality child care experience, is 288. So that educational achievement gap is already happening well before they enter the kindergarten room. So that's why we should all be very concerned educationally, human development-wise, as well as economically. You don't have child care, we don't have a long-term, you know, success for people in our Valley region.
Right. And while early childhood development and the necessary and comprehensive support it requires is one thing, child care in and of itself is probably a need or a requirement well into the early teen years. So and I have to say, Team Incorporated has been around a long time, and you're blessed with the historical knowledge and all the data and anecdotes experiences that you and your team has collected over the many decades that you've been serving the Valley, century plus, right? How is the capacity, what's the capacity question? Does the Lower Naugatuck Valley have the necessary amount of early childhood providers and providers for older children that it needs, or are you still in a deficit mode?
We are in a significant deficit mode. That's a really good question. So, unfortunately, we have the worst of all aspects of this due to the lack of a public investment. So, there are. When you look at that community index that the foundation and others released, there are approximately 3,500 infant and toddlers, children under the age of three, in households. However, there are only 830 licensed child care slots in the Valley region. Wow. So that's a gap of 2,600. So even families who are looking for gainful employment, looking for for a quality of life, they can't even access a child care site because there's such a significant shortage of child care access. And again, that is highly related to what I said earlier as far as the cost factor falling on the backs of families, but also on workers who are just not adequately paid as they should be, like the K-12 system.
So how is the value
from a story? From an anecdotal story perspective, I think this really brings it home. Is, you know, you mentioned team. We really appreciate those words, and we see it every week. Families looking at us saying, "I can't afford the $300 a week
per kid
in order to per kid." However, to go to work, but I can't get the job because I don't have the child care. I can't. It's a catch-22.
Right,
so they're trying
circle,
to find child care. Yeah. So it's those stories are so palpable and real every week. People who really want to go to work, but they can't find the child care and they can't afford it. But they can't afford it because they can't land the job. And so that's where Team and many others try to eradicate that little area, that barrier.
Great. Well, we're gonna circle back, hopefully in the last few minutes, to just talk a little bit about how Team's collaboration with the Valley Community Foundation and its resources are going to begin to address this. But we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about the other component, never mind the equivalent of a mortgage payment just to get childcare. The folks then got to earn the mortgage payment too, or at least the rent or the lease for where they are going to live. We'll come back and talk about housing and its relation to the Valley Community Foundation's latest index of folks and homes in the Valley with David Morgan, President and CEO of Team Incorporated. Stay with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Jane Doe No More, an organization founded in 2007 to empower survivors of sexual crimes to find their voice, advance their healing, and educate others, recently launched John Doe No More, a new initiative directed toward men who have been victimized by sexual crimes. The agency website now offers male survivors ways to find resources, hear stories from other men, and get support. If you're a victim suffering in silence or you know one, visit the John Doe No More page for more information on male survivors of sexual crimes by going to janedoenomore.org. Well, we're back and very pleased to be having a great conversation, very enlightening and educational, also very concerning, with David Morgan. He's president and CEO of Team Incorporated. You may recall a couple of weeks ago, we hosted the leadership of the Valley Community Foundation as they unveiled their latest community index report. And we decided we are going to begin to focus on a number of individuals and agencies who are collaborating to try to make a positive difference given the data that has been most recently revealed. We spent the first segment talking about early childhood development and child care. Now we're going to turn our attention to housing. So, David, at this point, in terms of any information or knowledge that you have, tell us a little bit more about the housing situation in the Valley, the availability for those who need it, and their ability to afford it.
Thank you, John. And again, so I don't think this will be any shocker to anybody, but the housing crisis is more real than ever, and it's impacting almost everyone. And what's more terrifying is that what we know at Team and many others throughout the Valley region is that housing is arguably the most important and aspect, and it's so unique in that it has an impact on virtually every aspect of our lives. You know, the research and the data is very clear. When we think about housing policy is education policy. There's clear correlation between housing instability to poor student attendance, lower academic achievement. Housing is the key core social determinant toward population health and wellness. So healthcare institutions who do social determinant screenings, housing is a headliner, and it impacts health and wellness and results in chronic health conditions, and housing is the key foundation toward economic opportunity and developing one's income. It is that important. All roads lead to housing as far as us at Team and myself are concerned. And when you look at that Valley Community Index, a third of all households in the Valley are cost burdened. And frankly, what that means is they are spending more than 30 cents to every hardworking dollar for the roof over their head. And 15% are severely cost burdened, you'll see in that community index, meaning they're spending more than 50 cents to every dollar they're working for the roof over their head. And so when you get into those, anytime you're spending more than 30 cents to the dollar, individuals and families and households and our whole workforce, frankly, throughout the Valley region are faced with difficult decisions of, you know, I've got to pay for the rent or pay for the mortgage, but how much do I have left after I pay 40, 50, 60 cents to the dollar for my medicine, my transportation, childcare if I have kids, heating oil, you know, utilities, that's another headliner right. that is bearing down on people. So we really, you know, and for us at Team, and many of our partners in this Valley region, it's really amplified in the index. Two areas here. We really need to look at the supply of affordable workforce housing. Number one, Connecticut is way behind on having attainable, affordable workforce housing. And number two, we need to increase the understanding and sensitivity to the issue. Unfortunately, when we say the two words, affordable housing, we can't get three sentences deeper because we there's this unfortunate stigma attached to it.
Immediate flashback to our grandfather's affordable housing.
Exactly. And what I would ask others all to look at, you know, we call it just holding up the mirror to the community. Look at the fair market rate for a basic two-bedroom apartment in Connecticut is $1,446. Okay, and it can fluctuate, but that's the fair market rate. And in order to avoid paying more than 30% of your income, you would need to be earning $27.80 per hour at a 40-hour a week job just to afford that. So when we think about affordable housing and how critical it is to ensuring a promising future for our Valley region, we're talking about our first responders. We're talking about our child care workers. We're talking about our entry-level healthcare workers. We're talking about paralegals. We're talking about our hospitality workers, et cetera. We're talking about our essential workers, don't we? That responded and were in the front line, never went home throughout COVID-19.
Yeah.
Don't we want to support and empower them by increasing the supply of affordable workforce housing.
Right.
So when you look at those rates, that's really what we're talking about. But to your point, John, I think we're still stuck, and it's no one's fault. It's not irrational, but I think we're still stuck in that post-World War II, you know, gangs and bullets, forgive me, for lack of a better phrase, affordable housing. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about our friends, our families, our neighbors, one another.
Yeah, and even the physical plant of the housing that we're talking about is completely different. And I could see where your concern before we started was that we could actually probably spend an entire segment on each of these components. And I don't mean to make it short, but I'm glad you brought off COVID because it's got to keep you up nights that the fact that so many landlords during the COVID era, at least the earliest two-thirds or more of it, were in situations where they may not have been able to collect any rent, but were bound to keep their tenants and lessees in their properties, in their homes. And it seems like that just took the starting line in a race that you may have been able to see the finish line and move that starting line back double the distance.
That's right. I think that was, you hit the nail right on the head there. I think that was one of the tragedies of, you know, when as we all were navigating COVID-19 and you'd see the headliners around the impact on small business, the loss of small business or losing a part of themselves trying to survive. And to your point, when we saw that, you need to replace that with the landlords. A lot of landlords, a lot of really good, purposeful, productive, community or based supportive landlords really got the really bad end of the stick in that deal, and how we really need to address that. And at the same time, the absentee landlords and the ugly realities of landlords who are not building better communities and not ensuring, you know, ensuring and increasing access for workforce housing and making the most of educational and economic and employability and social opportunities. But these things can be solved. Housing is very complex, but they can be solved.
Well, I look forward to our future conversations in concert with other partners and the leadership of the Valley Community Foundation when we eventually turn this series toward the mechanics of addressing and solving the problems. But in the meantime, you've left us with a ton of things to think about because the issues that are impacting the Central and Lower Naugatuck Valley are replicated across the state of Connecticut and within our listening area. areas. So we really appreciate the conversation this morning. David Morgan is president and CEO of Team Incorporated in this segment of our look into the Valley, the latest Valley Community Index and the good work of the Valley Community Foundation. So David, thank you for your time today. So as we mentioned in our introduction this morning, we are here in September, National Recovery Month, and one of our radio station's great partners here in Connecticut is Aware Recovery Care. They provide innovative substance use disorder treatment with an approach that's really simple, direct, and it works. They believe every person deserves and can achieve lasting recovery without having to leave their home. Dr. Shelley Hallinan is back with us again. She's Vice President of Medical Services for Aware Recovery Care. Shelley, if I may call you that, how is everything
going? Absolutely.
How's everything going here during Recovery Month?
It's going very well. It's very very nice to have you back here with you today and talking about something that's very near and dear to my heart, and that is recovery.
So people may have heard, commercials and other marketing that we're airing on our radio stations and on our websites. But for those who may know someone or love someone who could use recovery support, or an individual themselves who may be coming out of COVID and the COVID era that we've been through, saying, wow, I've really started consuming a lot more alcohol than I want to, or worse, we've been, exposed to opioids or other addictive substances, and we really need to put a stop to this. Tell us a little bit about how Aware Recovery Care really works in this innovative approach that you guys have.
Absolutely. So Aware is, like you said, it's very innovative. It's very out of the box and unique. So an individual has, like you said, they may find themselves in a situation where they're abusing prescription medication, using alcohol or other illicit substances, and may need help. Aware is up to a 52-week in-home addiction treatment program where we actually age, gender, and story match the team to the individual and provide all the services in the person's home, which is such a sacred place for us to be. The other really unique thing that we do is we include the family as part of the treatment team. It's very different than in a person going away to an inpatient facility for 30, 60, 90 days, which they may need to do. We certainly partner with a lot of inpatient support and facilities. But this approach allows individuals to stay at home with their family, with their friends, with their pets, in their own bed, and really be able to include the family and their network in their recovery process.
Well, we're going to dive a lot deeper and talk to directly to those family members that may be coming engaged in the support and recovery of a loved one in just a couple of minutes. But I really want to hear a lot more about your team and the types of expertise that are being strategically matched to each individual client that comes to Aware Recovery Care. What are the types of expertise that are being invited into the homes of individuals who really want to get their lives back under control?
Great question. So when the person is referred, or when they call in themselves, they can actually call, they can call into Aware and they can refer themselves, or a family member, they can call to get information themselves. They're getting all the information that they possibly can. What substance are they using? What is the treatment history? What is the medical comorbidities that they individual have? They need detox. Are they safe? That's our number one priority. And then we start developing that treatment plan right away. And that treatment treatment plan development begins with a psychiatrist, our medical directors, nurse practitioners, psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners, and we look at the overall picture and we'll do a full assessment of the individual. The team is made up with a nurse, a social worker. Those individuals are kind of our care coordinators. They really work with the providers in the community because we want primary care involved. We want your OBGYN involved. We want your whomever is part of your medical team involved in this care as well. So that part of it is set up. When we look at your therapy, do you need therapy? We have in-house therapy that we work with the patient, and we also do therapy with the family. We also look at the family system. So we know that the individual themselves are struggling with substance use disorder, but the individual does not usually the only person that has a problem, right? It usually the system is broken, meaning that the family has been trying to help with the patient. They're trying to manage their jobs. They're trying to help them with legal issues. So mothers, brothers, fathers, sisters suddenly become case managers, suddenly become, you know, monitoring this individual, making sure that they're okay. We want people to become back to those relationships. So we want to step in as the experts and become the substance use disorder treatment experts so that the family members can get back to their place. So we have family education facilitators that work with the family. Teach them about addiction. Teach them about what is going on inside the brain when addiction does take over the person's lives, because it's not a moral failing. It's not a judgment. It's not a choice. These individuals, you know, what happens in the brain, alcohol now becomes making all the decisions for the person, or the opiates, they make all the decisions for the person. So we give the family a really good sounding board, a lot of education, and a lot of support so they're able to understand how to work with the loved one that's in their life. And then we have certified recovery advisors, and these are the individuals that have lived experience. And these individuals are absolute amazing rock stars. They develop that trust that they can look at across the table from that individual and they say, I've been exactly in your shoes. I know exactly what it's like. Yes, I put alcohol in my shampoo bottle too. Yes, I stole and I did these things too. They really normalize the things that people have so much shame and guilt over, that is what keeps people sick and suffering for so long. People are actually afraid to talk to their provider sometimes about the substances they're abusing because they're afraid of what they're going to hear. You know, when you say something to someone that says, I can't stop drinking, I drink all day, and they look at you and they say, well, why wouldn't you do that? Or just stop, or just say no. Well, that shuts off the conversation, right? But if you have somebody that says, I understand, I've been there, I can relate to what you're doing, and I'm going to help you rewrite your story, and I'm going to walk beside you while you do it. That's a game changer for most individuals with substance use disorder.
So at this point, I guess one of the most important things I could ask you to speak to is the individuals who are doing diagnosis and treatment by Google. They're strictly relying on either social networks or web searching to try to get the answers to do it themselves. I don't imagine that from 10,000 feet, you're seeing an equal level or even a fractional level of success taking that route.
You know, it's all over the place. I kind of equate it to, you know, I don't know anything about working on cars. I can Google and look to see what this noise might be in my car. I might get it right. I might not. And if I start taking my car apart and adding different things to it, or maybe not the right oil or maybe not the right gas, I can do actually more damage to my car than if I took it to an expert. Exact same thing with substance use disorder. You know, I can Google, hey, this, you know, this substance will help this, or this will help this, or take this amount of herbs. But what may really be happening is you may be causing more damage. You may be causing yourself more problems. So, you know, I can understand that people are desperate and they're fearful. And a lot of that is because, like I said, the shame. Yeah. So they want to fix it themselves. And I understand that. I mean, most of us in this field, we have such compassion and so much empathy that there's no judgment. I mean, I get it. I understand why people would want to be able to do that. But allow
experts in the field of substance use disorder give you the right tools, the right medication possibly, the right resources to be able to find recovery. And now I want to say whatever that looks like for you, because people's recovery can look very, very different, and that's okay. We understand that at AWARE. So your recovery might look different than my recovery. My recovery is going to look different than my neighbor's recovery. And we understand that, and I think that's the other piece that's very unique about AWARE. Is very client-centered. We come and, you know, I've had people that'll say, I don't want to stop drinking altogether. I want to learn how to drink on the weekends. I want to do this. I want to do that. And the likelihood of them accomplishing that is up in the air. It may not be total abstinence for every single person. What we are trying to do is save individuals' lives. We are seeing more people die than we ever have in our entire careers from substance use disorder. So we're at the point now, we want to save your life, not tell you how you should recover.
So in the last minute or so that we have with you, Shelley, what a call from a loved one to AWARE Recovery Care will bring is relief from being forced into, as you so aptly pointed out earlier, being a case manager for this loved one, to being a cheerleader and part of the actual solution and support network. And that's why the call from the loved one to AWARE Recovery Care is really the most important way to start. And you can go online and go to awarerecoverycare.com and get comfortable with what the organization can offer before you make the call. And that's what's most important. But here in September, National Recovery Month, it's time for loved ones to step up, forget the stigmas, and play a role in making it happen.
And it's a courageous call. I just want to say it's a very courageous call, because families are fearful and families are terrified. And they're terrified of losing their loved one, but they're also terrified of making a disconnection. So maybe that, I'll hurt or damage the relationship. You are going to love your family to death if you don't make the call. So it's a courageous call, but it's one of love and compassion. And if you have that suspicion, if you have that pit in your stomach, if you know this person has a problem, pick up the phone and call us. There will be no judgment. There will be no big sales pitch. It will be, we're going to get you help. We understand where you are, and we want to see you thrive, and we want to see your loved one thrive.
With the most important component being it's all happening in the privacy and comfort and security of your own home. Dr. Shelley Halligan is VP of Medical Services for AWARE Recovery Care. Folks, it's Recovery Month, but every month is Recovery Month. If you're a loved one an individual with an addiction, go to awarerecoverycare.com and make that brave call today. Shelley, thank you so much. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.